Here's a fact. When I go to weddings, I want to hang out with a trashy cousin. So...
I made a bunch of mistakes, but I think they're all pretty funny now.
Yeah. Jake, please tell me you were recording so that we know we've got that great... That's going to be a great quote. The...
Tire les ficelles, tire les ficelles, ton polichinelle te tendra les bras.
Hello, and welcome to The Write-Up with Owen Edgerton. The Write-Up is a KUT-produced program that explores the lies behind literature, the stories behind the stories. And today, we are thrilled to have Deborah Munro. She is an award-winning author, a scholar, a mentor, a university professor. But she was raised, in her own words, to be a farmer's wife, a shopkeeper's wife, a telephone man's wife. Her new memoir, My Unsentimental Education, traces her journey from small-town Wisconsin to being a celebrated author. She's author of several books, including The Source of Trouble, which was the winner of the Flannery O'Connor Award for Short Fiction, and the acclaimed memoir, The Outskirts of Normal. I was also lucky enough to study with Deborah herself as a graduate student at the Texas State University. And it was with great pleasure that we have her here today on The Write-Up. Hi, Deborah. How are you?
Hi, Owen.
Thanks for being here this week. I know it's such a busy week. The book has just come out, and people are talking about it all over the place, and you're giving interviews and appearances. Thank you for taking time to come to the studios here in Austin.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Oh, good.
Wouldn't miss it.
So, Deborah, I really love My Unsentimental Education. I'm a big fan of your writing and have been for years, since before studying with you at Texas State. And I'm just thrilled that we get a chance to talk. I particularly love your memoirs. They make me laugh. They really strike a heart. They show me a world that I didn't know. And they're brutally honest and incredibly insightful all the way through. There are lines that I underlined and I dog-eared my book all the way through. I hope you're not opposed to dog-earing, because I dog-eared this book quite a bit. Would you mind reading a section of the book to get the conversation started?
Okay, I'll read maybe one from the beginning, early in the book, that describes my hometown.
Yeah.
Which was unusual. Okay. Families ran the local businesses, the dime store, the drug store, a clothing store, 2 bait and tackle shops, 3 gas stations, 26 bars, motels consisting of one-room comfy cabins, each with a cot, toilet, and sink. The economy of Spooner, a freight train stopover town and fishing destination, relied on men. I grew up knowing that whores had lived at the Depot Hotel until it burned to the ground when I was in middle school. One whore had fallen asleep while making a grilled cheese sandwich on a steam iron. A few still lived across the street from the Topper Cafe, above the strip joint, with windows facing the street. Strippers danced on a stage so passers-by saw naked legs. I assumed every town had prostitutes and strippers. People need money, I knew. These women didn't have diverse skills. They were part of the food chain, lower down. One of the post-hippies I'd been talking to on Saturdays, a man with a spade-shaped beard and sad eyes, his wife had just moved into his brother's bedroom because she was pregnant by the brother, pointed out that most towns don't keep whores and strippers on Main Street. He'd had a stutter when he was young. Spooner is less not hypocritical. And at this point in the book, I'm actually working at the Topper Cafe, and I'm about to serve food to Shelley and Bubbles, who are ex-carnies who own the movie theaters in town, including the drive-in movie theater. But that day in the cafe, Bubbles smiled and said I was the best waitress she ever met. Flattery, yet another currency. Nobody gets you to do something for nothing. I hadn't figured that out yet. You've found your true calling, she said. Why not moonlight selling concessions for us at the Palmote? Weeknights, I tended to watch TV with my parents, their marriage on life support. Uncomfortable silence in the flickering half-light of Charlie's Angels or Three's Company. Or maybe my dad didn't come home, went to one of the bars, and my mother confided gloomily that she'd done her part, cooking, raising children, the family bookkeeping, and having sex. Much ado about nothing that, she said. For what? It pays minimum wage, Bubbles added. Winter was coming on, I reasoned, deep drifts, slippery roads. It would be harder to get to the communes to visit the post-hippies. I decided instantly I was saving to buy a car to move to a city and be in the proletariat there. I said yes. I'd start at the Palmot that night, a Monday. The Palmot ran horror movies. I knew this because on weekend nights in high school, if the thermometer stayed above zero and snow wasn't expected, someone drove through the gate with a keg in the back of a pickup. We wore parkas and mittens as we milled and drank, the beleaguered babysitters and hitchhikers on the movie screen irrelevant. I didn't think to ask Shelley and Bubbles if they played horror movies on weeknights.
Which, of course, they don't.
No, it turned out that on weeknights they did only X-rated movies on the drive-in movie theater screen, which was huge, and it was right next to the Lutheran church. And I it was a small town, and how I didn't know that to this day.
It's one of the mysteries.
It's one of the mysteries. I lasted one night because it turns out I'm a bit of a prude.
Well, that's one of the really fascinating things about this book. You're a bit of a prude, but your book also explores, well, a lot of romantic adventures.
Right.
And misadventures.
Well, it was the 1970s and 80s when I came. It was the late 70s and 80s when I came of age, and it was the era of intoxication. So, you know, there were some drugs around, and it was also the so-called 30th sexual revolution, you know?
Yes.
So, I'm never graphic when I write about sex.
No, not graphic.
I just indicate that sex has been had. And I weigh in a little bit on how likely it was to make me return.
Right, yes. Yes. There's often one word describing it, whether it's practical or aggressive or athletic, I believe, was one.
Muted.
Muted. That was another I particularly liked.
I couldn't tell if the sex was muted or if his love was.
There's always a thin line between the two. Let me ask you, you've written four works of fiction, short stories and novels, and then your last book, Before My Unsentimental Education, was also a memoir. What drove this memoir? What was it about this particular story of you coming of age and moving into a profession of being an acclaimed professor and writer, coming from the small town, working class family? What made you want to tell this story?
Well, I do think in general that nonfiction works better for stories that if you tried to tell them as novels, people would say, that plot is too high concept.
Yeah.
And so that's why, I wrote my last book about raising my daughter in Wimberley, you know, which was pretty much all white. And this was 18 years ago, so it was one of the first transracial adoptions after the laws changed. And I did write that as a novel, and some of the reviews said, this novel is trying too hard to be politically correct. You know, I also had people who spoke Spanish in it, and, you know, black characters and white characters, and I was like, well, that's my world. And with this story, it's about coming from Spooner, Wisconsin, which really is like out of the 50s. It's a town out of the 50s almost, even in 1970, in that it had strippers and prostitutes right on Main Street. It was like the postman always rings twice. Mm. And that's odd enough, but I also came of age. My lifetime spanned to both the pre-feminist and the post-feminist generations.
Right.
And it was very complicated, and I lived in 6 states in 10 years. That would have been a lot to cover in a novel.
Right.
Too many settings.
Yeah.
And so I had to sort of play with that to make it even work in a memoir. And it was a story that couldn't be told as a novel. And also I thought at a certain point that it was a really interesting story. One of those stories no one would really believe unless you went into a little detail.
Right. Well, let me ask you this then. How does approaching a memoir versus approaching a novel on the writing basis, how is that a different process?
Well, they're very similar, actually, because they're driven by a central tension or a central conflict,
yeah,
which in this book is the conflict between feeling like I should be a housewife and mother and this continual call to step out of that childhood conditioning for a female role. And you make scenes, you use dialogue. It's very much like writing a novel. And in fact, the book was just reviewed this weekend as a novelish memoir by Sarah Nelson at Amazon.
Yeah.
And that those parts are the same. The part that is really different is that nonfiction requires you to use hindsight or retrospective to weigh in and have an opinion and to have your older self comment on your younger, dumber self.
Right. Yeah.
Which I think is more fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
Rather than implying it.
I imagine, too, I was thinking while reading this of like, gosh, goodness gracious, what would it be to go back to fights or romances or situations 20 years before and try and describe them now, simultaneously describe them how it was going through them. And I don't know if I'd have the ability to do it.
Well, I have a good memory, which has always bothered every single one of the men I was involved with. You know, when you have those fights
where
you can remember everything. You have a memory like a lawyer. But I do have a good memory. And, you know, this is my sixth book. Writing for 25 years makes you hone that memory for concrete details. So your memory gets better for the weird, quirky details that you don't want to forget.
Right.
But as far as like remembering exactly what happened, you don't remember exactly what happened. You remember what you remember your memory.
Mm.
It's a little bit like photographs. You look at a photograph and you don't actually imagine the occasion, but you know where you were and you know what you felt like that summer.
Yeah.
And that whole notion about is it true or not? I didn't put anything in here that wasn't untrue, but it's certainly all of the memories are conditioned by retrospective, by what I think of them now. In fact, a lot of these stories are material I covered when I was in my 20s.
Mm.
Not exactly, but, you know, the same kind of lifestyle, the same kind of people as fiction. But my perspective on them now is amused. And my perspective on them when I was 20 was a little wry and feisty, but I saw it as darker, I think, darker material.
Sure. Gosh. Well, I suppose, too, I mean, your memoir does go to dark places. And it's wonderfully balanced in that way, in that there is this amused tone that lightens up. But there are places that are incredibly dark. There's death, there's abuse, there's betrayal, and there's plenty of people standing in your way saying you cannot achieve what you hope to achieve. Was it in that way, like, was that difficult to go back to those places and relive those conversations and incidents?
Well, not terribly, because one of the impetuses to write the book, we'd been at the end of a year where there had been several funerals in my current family, my great third husband, and I, you know, my wonderful stepson and my wonderful daughter. We'd been at the end of a year where there'd been several deaths in his family and a big health scare. And I was recovering. And I was watching my daughter walk halfway up the stairs and pause. And I thought, it's a good thing she doesn't know how hard it is to make your way in life, because if she knew, she'd give up right now.
Hmm.
And I thought how we must be hardwired to do that, to be fearless and certain we know more than our parents and unwilling to take our parents' advice when we're young. And I looked around the house, our beautiful house, and I could, you know, hear all the sounds of the house, my stepson, my daughter, my husband in the other room. And I thought, what a miracle it was I'd landed here. And it was a sort of quiet joy that made me want to account for every step of the way.
Yeah.
All the wrong turns. I mean, that's the point of the book, right? All the wrong turns that I write it again eventually.
Yeah. You have a beautiful section where you talk about your first time taking LSD, which is beautiful and terrifying and full of twists. And part of that was you talk about pretending. about constantly having to pretend that you are this person to your roommates, that you are this person to your lover, that you're another person to your professor, and not really finding out who you are. So it feels like a lot of the memoir is not just growing into who you are, but kind of finding, recognizing, and owning who you are. Do you feel like, when is that place in your life where you said, okay, here I am, this is me, and I'm no longer pretending?
About 5 years ago.
5 years ago.
And I'm 57. When you knew me, I used to every day walking into class past the statue of LBJ on the quad.
Yeah.
Every single day and touch his hand and tell him to wish me luck. I always felt that if people knew I was Debbie Fregane, which people used to pronounce Friggin, from Spooner, Wisconsin, instead of Deborah Monroe, PhD, they'd never let me teach the class or something like that. I had imposter syndrome forever. And you're right, the two threads and the tension in the book is about synthesizing two selves or many selves. Mm-hmm. And that's the point of the image on the cover, too, which I found and argued for. But it's a dressmaker's dummy, an antique one, which would have been from my grandmother and mother's generation. But she's naked. Well, as dressmaker's dummies are, but wearing pearls, so she looks a little sexy, too.
Mm-hmm.
And she's on wheels. It's like a woman in search of an identity, and I'm sure you noticed this in the book. Every time I moved, I sewed furiously because I didn't have much clothes, mm-hmm. to try to look like who I was supposed to be in this new guise. I mean, a country western singer's wife at one point, somebody who looks right with a drug dealer, somebody who looks right with a hog farmer. And when I moved to North Carolina, I owned a lime green miniskirt for the only piece of lime green clothing I've ever owned in my life. But I noticed in North Carolina that all of the women were wearing very bright colors. So I was really trying to blend and act, or, you know, pretend, as you say, acting as in theatrical acting wherever I went. And that blending is camouflage, or what biologists call adventitious protective coloration.
Yeah.
I was just trying to not be noticed as an interloper and an outsider.
Gosh, yeah. I'm very familiar with that feeling. I mean, I think...
You are?
Yeah, yeah. Gosh.
Everyone is, right. Yeah.
I think those sections sort of struck me like, oh, yeah, I know that feeling. And I was thinking, you know, you opened the book talking with students and the idea of like... students thinking, oh, I see who you are, you're a success, you're this, and there's a constant thing of like, your students now are probably in a very similar place of like, how do I maintain the expectations from my family as I'm working for a degree in creative writing, and how do I be a woman in the expectations of society, and which is changing as well. Do you feel that in some ways this is like a letter to people in those situations? Like, who are you reaching out to with this book?
It's a more extreme version of every ambitious woman's story. Mm. It's more extreme because of where I came from, Spooner, Wisconsin, in 1970, and ending up in, you know, with a PhD and in the so-called ivory tower. You know, it's a little bit bigger than saying I want to become the head of my department in the office or something.
Right.
It's a little bit bigger of a leap. I didn't have any role models. I'm still the first person in my family to have a bachelor's degree. And it's more extreme, too, because of being raised in the Mad Men era, but the Midwestern housewife version, where it was, you know, working class.
Right.
More like, if for people who know Joanne Beard's book, The Boys of My Youth, mm-hmm. it's... My childhood was more like her childhood. My mother was more like her aunt and mother. Smoking cigarettes, drinking coffee, complaining, but taking care of the kids and working very, very hard. And talking a lot about what was a good woman and what was a good mother. And I heard that over and over again. So, yes, it is a message to anyone who's trying to have come from somewhere and to be something extremely different. And it's just more a more extreme version.
Yeah, yeah. You said that you felt like 5 years ago was when you landed. And you're like, oh, this is who I am. Do you think that has anything to do with the transition from writing fiction to memoir? Does that have any correlation?
I think, I'm not sure. I think when you're young and you move out of where you come from, you keep thinking that your real self is the self back home.
Sure.
And that's why I kept dating these drug dealers, guys in bands, unemployed guys.
Yeah.
Because work was so hard. School was so hard by day. So at night, I wanted to relax and not have to pretend. But after a while, you do start becoming this person who's taken in new information. You're not who you were back home.
Yeah.
And it took me a real long time to figure out that I wasn't that blue collar anymore.
Right.
In fact, I'm not that comfortable visiting home. It really unsettles me. I always feel it's a miracle I got out the first time and that they're not going to let me out a second time, which is irrational at this age. You ask who I thought the audience was.
Yeah.
I'm already hearing from people because even though the pub date's been very recent, online it's been for sale for a little while. But, and I had that article in Salon.
Right.
I got so many letters from strangers, women in their 30s, who said, none of this has changed. None of this has changed. Meaning that they have ambition.
Right.
And it really complicates your romantic life. Because there are men who are as ambitious as you, but they don't necessarily want to be with an ambitious woman. Very few do. Is that awful? Some men don't want to be with an ambitious woman, or they met her in their 20s and they're already married. And your choices are to date down, which is sort of a scandal if you're a female, though you don't see many female doctors married to male nurses, but you see a few male doctors married to female nurses, that sort of thing. Secretaries, executives marrying their administrative aides, that tends to be male to female.
Right.
My doctor, who's a woman, is married to another doctor. And once you are ambitious and hit a certain level of professional accomplishment, there just are less men who have the same level of accomplishment.
Right.
And out of those men, some of them aren't interested in you because they don't want to be in a marriage with two high-pressure careers. And you also have to like that person and be sexually attracted to them.
Yep, that's right. I guess that limits, that narrows down the field.
And one woman said, you're so lucky you missed the Tinder generation. one of my letters.
I was going to ask that. I'm glad that you brought up the Salon article and responses to it, because I was wondering, like, how have things changed since the 1970s, and how have they not? I think the common perception is that we are progressing as a country, and our views about equal rights and equal opportunities, but I wouldn't totally believe that actually under the surface there's still a lot of these chauvinistic or insecurities lurking.
Well, and I want to add that women are complicit. You know, the feminist movement was in the 60s and 70s, but a manifesto, this is what I was naive about when I was coming of age, a manifesto is not going to undo centuries of tradition. And I have a friend who argues it's biology, and I won't go there. You know, that we have biological imperatives and we'll never escape our gender. I'm a lot more hopeful that that's true, but there's no way a few decades are going to change centuries of attitudes about agency, power, sexual attraction, and even women participate in those kinds of stereotypes. Some of it's changed. I hear sometimes from women in their 30s, and you're wondering why people tell me this stuff. Well, sometimes they write to me and tell me this stuff.
Yeah.
But they say, I married this man who told me he was a feminist, but I'm constantly arguing with him to spend more time with the children, to treat child care as something we both do and not to see it as really giving me relief.
Right.
To help with the housework. And I feel really, really lucky that I married, you've met him, Gary, my husband. He's a little bit older than me, And he was a feminist in 6 years before I was, when I was still in high school. And he didn't ever doubt the rightness of it.
Yeah.
And he really does take care in every single way. It's a very good partnership.
Yeah.
I'm very grateful. Maybe that had more to do with feeling my two selves came together.
Yeah. Gary.
Yeah. And he's from a blue collar past too. He changed schools 27 times by seventh grade. His parents had eighth grade educations, and he's an attorney. So coming from pasts like that and having worked our way to higher ed and through higher ed the way we did, well, for him, law school, it's an orientation. It affects everything we think about child rearing, how much money to spend, how much money not to spend, how flashy or not flashy, would be the key phrase, to be with the money that you have. And so it's an easy partnership.
Yeah, but you find common ground.
Right, and I don't think, I'd kind of given up on ever meeting anyone.
You discuss that in the book, yeah.
Yeah, like I thought, if you have this past that's Duck Dynasty, and now you're a professor, you know, you want someone who can take both of those sides and discuss both of those sides of life. And I met him.
Yeah.
It's a miracle.
Let me ask this. The memoir is already getting great reviews. And as you're saying, like the excerpts and the articles that you've had from it are getting great reactions from people. But it wasn't a no-brainer for publishers. You had a hard time. But some publishers, would tell me a little bit what publishers were saying. I mean, your last memoir was such a success. When I read about that, I was surprised to find out that some publishers hesitated.
Well, I think this part's true too, and I may as well just own it. This is my sixth book, and you only have so many chances in New York, especially right now, where there isn't a lot of room for mid-list writers.
Yeah.
To have your breakout book that really sells well and gets optioned for a movie, and Reese Witherspoon is going to star in it or something.
Lord, don't I know it.
Yeah, you only... And so I think there's that. You know, they have Nielsen scans on your sales. And there used to be a time, and not in my career, in the last 25 years, where there were spaces for us. Editors made a lot of money on the big books and saved some money for books like these.
Yeah.
And but now you just have to sell very, very quickly within 6 months, or you're remaindered and shredded.
Right.
And I have a very, very good agent, very high power agent, very well known in the business. And she was sure she could sell this book and was a little surprised she couldn't. But the rejections talked about memoir is now seen as a recovery memoir, and
yeah,
that I hadn't recovered from something extreme enough. And so it's a complicated book. I mean, it's comic. It's a little bit of a Horatio Alger story, but how it plays out differently with a female lead. It's a little bit about feminism and being that first cohort of women entering white-collar professions. And it's also about strange ex-boyfriends.
Yeah.
And so it couldn't be summarized in a phrase. So two things were against it. One rejection letter did say, it's too bad her childhood wasn't worse, because then I could market this. I would know how to position it.
Oh, no.
And another one said, we're really not buying books that can't be described in a phrase, or that we can't subtitle on the cover so that people know exactly what they're about.
That was the one that I had read about. I read about that in the Houston Chronicle and an interview you gave, and they had quoted that, which is remarkable. I was shocked. I was shocked to read that.
I can summarize this book in a sentence, but I need dependent clauses. I couldn't summarize it in a phrase.
Right.
Here's my shortest
version. Yeah, I would love to hear it.
The Horatio Alger story, as it plays out differently for a woman, but it's also about social class jumping and the unease you feel as you do it, how you don't fit where you came from and you don't fit where you've ended up. It's kind of a lonely, disorienting life. But here's my one sentence with dependent clauses.
Great.
It's a book about how I left the oddest of small towns and improbably earned a PhD feeling like an imposter every step of the way. So at night and on weekends, I wanted to feel relaxed, so I dated what the book... This is a really long sentence. So I dated what the book jacket politely calls blue-collar men. But we all know that that's really a euphemism. They were not... Some of them didn't have legal employment, and some of them... A lot of them were unemployed.
Yeah. They were the cream of the crop on OkCupid.
No. And that's one of the things that I bring up in the book is when you leave home, and we all do that now, you go out into the world to make your career and your life. And when you try to date and woo and romance, you don't have much information on the person you're meeting.
Right.
If you stay in the same region your whole life, and if it's a small town or a tight-knit neighborhood in an urban community, you probably met through friends, or you know people who know people. You know people who know the person you're interested in, and you have access to all this, what I call dating letters of reference or character references for the person you're dating. But for most of us now, we move and go out. We live very transiently.
Yeah.
And we date people that we find out the strangest things about after we've been involved with them for several months. There's a line in the book where I say, disagreeing about space travel, you know, or the moon landing should be a deal breaker. Or is it?
I think the "or is it" is what I love most about that. Because, right, goodness gracious. Let me ask this, talking about your career, a lot of the folks who listen to the write-up, they're book lovers, but there are also a lot of them are writers themselves. And it's always fascinating to hear about the career, the steps, the missteps of how someone became a success. So The Source of Trouble won the Flannery O'Connor Award for Short Fiction. And when you talk about that in the book, you talk about it as being luck.
Yeah.
That part of this was luck. And saying, you know, there's so many people who enter these contests, there's different judges, all these different things. And I was shocked by that part because the book also talks about how much work you put into writing, into honing your craft, into supporting yourself while you're in school at the same time.
And a husband.
And a husband. But I was curious about that. Like, how do you view luck, and what part does luck play in a writer's career?
Well, all careers have ups and downs, and we know now, for instance, that The Great Gatsby was considered a bad novel when F. Scott Fitzgerald was alive.
Right.
He died thinking it was a bad novel, and he was washed up. Barbara Pym is a writer from England who published from 1955 to 1977, who I love. Mm-hmm. She was unpublished. She had four novels, and then no one would touch her for 15 years. And then two people mentioned her in the Sunday Times as one of the most underrated novels of the century.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, a publisher wants everything she has, and she's a finalist for the Man Booker Award. And she'd written 10 novels that she couldn't publish after the first four. So there is luck. She said in her journals, "I can't believe John Lennon can get a book published right now and I can't." Because she'd had five books published and they'd been produced as radio programs. Luck is always part of it. There are publishing trends. I had a low period right around my third and fourth book. Part of it was the switch to mall bookstores away from independent bookstores, the arrival of the internet, losing all of the newspapers, losing their book pages because there weren't any bookstores to pay for the ads to run them. And I wrote a novel then that I think is one of my best novels that is my least selling one. And so I was also a new mother with a sick baby. She was ill at the time. My mother died suddenly. So it was a time I couldn't tend to things, but I also didn't see the big picture of how the industry was changing and how to do things. So luck is always part of it. And as far as being lucky to win the Flannery O'Connor Award, every story in that collection had been rejected 20 to 25 times a piece. And at the time I won the Flannery O'Connor Award, I'd only published two stories, and they were at places where I'd actually been solicited for a manuscript. So I really thought I was going to be waitressing forever with a PhD. When I won that award, no one was more surprised than me. Nobody. And I knew as soon as I won it, I would be able to get a teaching job. And I actually had six offers before I'd finished the PhD, which is why everything's so crazy in my marital romantic life at that moment, because things were happening so fast, I couldn't even make a decision about what to do with the unemployed, angry husband.
Right. Yeah, he went on the back burner.
Yeah, at the end of that chapter, I'm telling someone on the phone that I'm not taking the job they're offering me, and they can't believe it because they're so pleased with their program and their job. And a snowstorm is happening. This is in Salt Lake City in the 80s, and we live on this really busy street. And a woman crashes her car into my house while I'm on the phone turning down this job offer, which I'm finding very difficult to do, like turning down a date or something. And then later the woman comes in the house, and her niece or daughter comes to take her home because she's very rattled. The niece or daughter says she must have hit the gas when she meant to hit the brakes. And that's the last line of that chapter. And that has everything to do with my marriage and my move at that point. I'd won the Flannery O'Connor Award. I did job interviews all over the country, a person who'd been on a plane twice and hadn't even finished my foreign language exam for the degree. And my husband was making noises about not wanting to leave Salt Lake City, even though he'd always hated it, which I later realized was an objection to moving for your wife's career.
Right.
And I just kind of plowed ahead, because what else are you going to do? Plus, you don't get a lot of second chances.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, in the book, you have so many experiences where something breaks you out. The winning of the Flannery O'Connor Award, different romances, different experiences, adopting a child, marrying your third husband. One of the earliest ones is you talk about the moment when you learned to read. And when the code was cracked, is the way you describe it. Will you talk a little bit about how that changed your world?
It was instantaneous. My parents had been gone for the first 2 weeks of second grade. And when I came back, the other kids in the classroom were reading short sentences. And I'm one of those people who won't try anything I'm not very good at. So I don't roller skate or ski. And I just wouldn't try. At age six, I was just stubborn, just angry, and I wouldn't try. And she would ask me to read the word see, and I would say S-E-E, very, very hostily. And she phoned my mom, and her name was Mrs. Fricky. She was a wonderful woman. And she kept me after class one day and made me sound out a couple of words. And it was very instant. I was like, oh, I get it. And so I quickly read the whole book she had in front of me, and then I went home and read the newspaper. There's a picture of it in a photo album my mother had. I'm wearing a dress with a rooster on the front, a huge rooster on the front, reading the newspaper. And from that moment on, I was reading so fast and so often that I was getting in trouble for it. I was accused of falsifying book reports. I read books way over my head in third and fourth grade, or that should have been over my head. I mean, this won't sound huge to you, but I think I was in third grade when I read Gone with the Wind.
That's pretty impressive.
I was missing some of it, but I was following enough of it. And I just couldn't get enough books in a town that size. I'd read through the children's section very quickly. And I was getting to be a better reader, so I wanted harder stuff.
Was it just expanding your world? I mean, was that for a way like, there's more than Spooner, Wisconsin? Or what do you think was so alluring?
There must have been that. I also think of it like Valium or something. Mm. It's still my go-to way of relaxing when I don't have much depression. It's sort of situational usually, like I need a good night's sleep or I haven't eaten. Mm-hmm. Or something's bothering me or I have the flu or something. I can't read books I want to read during the semester because I will stop doing everything else till I finish them. I can't read books I really want to read at bedtime because I will stay up till 4 a.m. to get to the end. It must be expanding my world. I think I was really bored with life in general. I had ennui, though I didn't know how to pronounce it yet.
Yeah.
I didn't see the point of much. And I still read for that reason. I want books to take me to another time and place. As I've gotten older, I read less and less contemporary fiction and more fiction that's not contemporary but historical, but that actually is old fiction.
Right.
Because I want to go somewhere else. And I want to enter another time. And one of the things I remember, my mother had bought the Encyclopedia Britannica because it had this encyclopedia of world literature and fables and folklore. And I spent a lot of time on that when I was a kid. And later on, I became very interested in medievalism when I was working on graduate degrees. And I think it may have started there because that is the folktale. The folktale is the literature of the Middle Ages.
The folktale is the literature of the Middle Ages.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And fairy tales. They weren't for children, you know. They were sort of popular entertainment and probably based on truth.
Yeah.
Hansel and Gretel was probably a true but exaggerated story.
Like a news story that everyone was talking about, these children being lost or these children being murdered.
Right. I mean, that whole notion that a man would marry a woman who wouldn't love his children was not a literary conceit. It was probably a reality.
Right. Huh. You're listening to The Write-Up, a KUT-produced podcast, and we are talking to Deborah Monroe and discussing her new memoir, My Unsentimental Education. Deborah, when was it? So you became a reader at a young age and read everything you could. When was it that you felt this calling not only to expand your education, but to be a writer?
Honestly, as soon as I learned to read, I was trying to imitate what I was reading. I wrote in handwriting these little westerns. I have no idea why. When I was in first and second grade and stapled them together and used masking tape for binding and would hand them around to the family.
Oh, self-publishing. Yeah.
Right. So I always wanted to be a writer. Always. And then in college, it turned out, it was a little college, but it turned out I was a pretty good writer in my littlish college. But when I graduated, I thought, well, that's enough of that. Mm. That's like wanting to move to Hollywood and being an actress. And I set out, and I got a master's degree in rhetoric so I could teach at a two-year college, which that scared me too. That was intimidating too. But I thought I just need to get practical now and stop writing. At that point, I said, it's a hobby.
I see.
And so when I started pursuing it in earnest, I had stopped writing for a year and a half after college when I was working in this weird little journalism job.
And it seems like at this point, this is where a lot of people stop. A lot of people say, gosh, I have a love of books. I have a love of written word. I have a love of the experience of creating with a written word. And then at some point, from outside pressures or inside pressures, they say, this belongs as a hobby.
You have to earn a living.
Right.
So I got this master's degree in rhetoric, and we were reading classical rhetoric, medieval rhetoric, contemporary composition theory. And all it did was unleash the desire to write fiction. And I started writing like crazy again, but it was still a sideline and a hobby because my main goal was to write this thesis with archival research. And then that husband, the country western singer, left me. So there was no reason not to get a PhD. And it felt irresponsible and whimsical everyone except one or two professors told me not to do it. But I said to myself, because I had a full scholarship and a stipend, well, it's inconveniencing no one but me, so I think I'm going to get this PhD. And then, of course, you had to write, because it was a PhD in creative writing / history of the novel. So I had to write for classes. And it was very, very hard again all of a sudden, because you're under scrutiny. And you were supposed to be publishing, and as I told you before, no one was publishing me until I won the Flannery O'Connor Award.
Right.
But yeah, I pretty much wanted to be that my whole life. I talk about this in the book, how my grandmother had given us, everyone, all 27 grandchildren, a scrapbook, And every year, at the end of your school year, you wrote down what you wanted to be when you grow up. And every year I wrote author, except one year I wrote missionary.
Right. There's still time if you want to be a missionary, by the way. That can be a second career for you.
There you go.
Let me ask you. I first met you as a teacher, as a professor, and also as a mentor to so many writers, writers that I love and admire, and you continue to teach in the MFA program at Texas State. What advice from your own career and your own craft do you feel are the essentials that you pass on to your students now, who are at that level where they're questioning, is this a career I can have? Is this something I should pursue?
Well, I'm glad you weren't asking me to summarize craft advice. Because it's always so individual to each student and each story. But I do say this to, well, when undergraduates say, should I get an MFA? I ask them what they want to do with it, what they expect it will bring them. But I tell everyone to be prepared to have a day job. Very, very few people. The only person I know of who really came from a working class background and lives off his writing entirely is Richard Russo.
Yeah, gosh.
I mean, there might be other people, but I don't know them.
Right.
And
I think Stephen King's doing okay these days.
Well, right. But he's had countless movie deals.
Yes.
And he's been on the bestseller list numerous times.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's right. But for more literary writing, you have to, it can bring in money. You know, we have a very good mutual friend in common here in Austin, but it doesn't consistently bring in money. You'll get a windfall and then you have 4 years where it's pretty lean. And I've made some good money on books. This is my sixth book. I wouldn't have been able to adopt and add onto my house if it hadn't been for my third book.
Right.
It was, and I bought a car too, paid cash for it. But when you count that up against 3 years to 4 years of writing it, 1 year of promoting it, it translates to about $10,000 a year.
Right. So the advice is pursue it, but realize you're career might involve things besides writing.
Well, you have to have another source of income.
Like public radio.
There you go. Well, maybe you don't have to have another source of income. I just don't have a starving artist bone in my body. I'm most productive when I feel as if I know the house I'm living in is still going to be there in 30 days and I know I can feed myself.
Yes, yeah.
I did want a middle-class life. I mean, I really did.
Yeah. Let me ask this. How did becoming a mother, you adopted your daughter. What year did you adopt your daughter?
She was born in 1997, and I adopted her when she was 2 days old.
And how did that change you as a writer?
Well, on a practical level, I stopped writing during the school year 100% and wrote my next three books in the summers only. On an emotional level, it made me see the bigger world. It's a good thing because by then I'd already written three books and I was bored with the subject matter that was presenting itself to me. And because she is African-American and because I met so many birth mothers when I was adopting her, I became a lot more aware of people whose lives were, especially because of the birth mothers, who were much harder than mine.
Yeah.
And I just think it expanded my sense of the world. And we talked about this briefly because I know you feel the same way. It makes you realize how fragile happiness is. When you love somebody that much, you realize that the price of love is great fear.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
Oh, knock on wood.
Yeah. I think there might be some wood here.
There is underneath.
Oh, underneath.
I found it.
We're at the KUT studios, by the way, in beautiful downtown Austin. And you're listening to The Write-Up with Owen Edgerton and our guest, Deborah Monroe. We're talking about her life as a teacher, as a mother, as a writer, and her most recent memoir, My Unsentimental Education. Let me ask, Deborah, I'm going to ask you to read one more section. Before I do, I want to ask you, writing a book for me and for other writers I've talked to is always, I think sometimes we go to write a book because we're looking for some change in our life, that this something we're working through or working towards or working away from. How did writing My Unsentimental Journey, My Unsentimental Education, Sentimental Journey, look at that. How did writing My Unsentimental Education change you?
Well, I don't know yet because it just came out 2 days ago. And I mean, I finished writing it about a year and a half ago. I have to say, I had a lot of fun writing it.
Yeah.
It made me feel lucky. It made me feel that can I read the last line?
Yeah, of course.
You have the book.
Oh, yeah.
I wasn't getting rid of the history, none of it, none of my irregular past, evidence that I'd had a vagrant heart, but a sense of direction too, an inclination toward the dark side, but the alchemy of luck had converted it to light.
That's Deborah Monroe reading the last lines from My Unsentimental Education. That is officially a spoiler here on the write-up of KUT's podcast. That was a literary spoiler.
Yes. And that isn't technically the last line. The last line is, we have just found one of my ex-husband's family trees and it's full of murderers and criminals and all sorts of people. And my wonderful husband has said from the easy chair, oh my God, these people are awful. Who would record this? And I had started rereading my second husband's family history and thinking, wow, this could be the family, you know, I married into and reproduced with. And that's that line. And then I say to my husband, you don't mind if I put this in the trash, do you? And he says, you mean the recycling. And that actually happened. And that was when I decided to write the book, when he said that, you mean the recycling.
Yeah.
And right around that time, the boyfriend who was wanted in the state of Indiana,
yes,
who wore an eye patch because he only had one eye, he contacted me.
Did he really?
Via the internet, yeah. Right around that same time. And I'm like, man, I've got to get some of this down.
Yeah.
Plus, I tried to, right around the same time, a neighbor had said something about her college experience. She's about 8 years older than me, and her mother's college experience. And she said, and for you, because you're a college professor. And I said, well, I dropped out after 3 months. And she said, and did what? And I said, I moved to Colorado with a guy who was wanted in Indiana. And she said, what? And she said, then what? And I said, well, then I went back and I started to say, and dated a drug dealer and thought I should keep it to myself, in the neighborhood at least. And all of those things happened at the same time. And I thought,
and it was the universe telling you to write this story.
Right.
I love the fact that you were talking about when I was a student, I guess that was 10 years ago at Texas State, that you were always thinking, gosh, if anyone knew the truth about everything, where I've come from, they wouldn't let me teach this class. And since then, you've written these books saying, here's who I am. And by the way, let this inspire you, including the people in your class.
A couple of students who've read excerpts that have been published from it have asked me, well, how does it feel to have that past showing in front of students and colleagues? And I said, I don't care. And I do think I'm a little more unbuttoned in front of, I mean, I don't talk about ex-boyfriends so much, but I'm a lot more relaxed than I used to be. Well, and it comes, you know, it comes up in creative writing classes because the stories have love and sex in them. They have altered states in them,
yeah.
what the students hand in. So you end up talking about this.
Right, yeah. Yeah, that is, yeah, life is the subject.
Right, yeah. Right.
Well, would you honor us by reading another section from your memoir?
Right. This is much later in the book. And at this point, I've left Spooner, gotten a master's degree in Kansas, divorced. I'm a 25-year-old divorcee, which is kind of weird in itself. And I've gone on to do a PhD at the University of Utah because I had the best scholarship there. And this is Salt Lake City in the 1980s, which was before they had the Winter Olympics. So it was very, very conservative.
Yes.
Still.
Yeah.
And that was another one of the local ambiances that I picked up too much, you know.
You were not from a Mormon family.
No, no, right. No. And yet I was raised to be a good woman who was polite and got along with everyone. And so I found being in, Salt Lake City was either at that time pretty much all Mormon or you were in the university. So it made it a really small town. Right. And this is, I've just had a come to Jesus talk with myself that I need to start dating people who match my present versus my past. And I guess that's a good enough setup. The next day, my devout neighbor's wife stood on the sidewalk and said, "Do you have a new boyfriend?" I must have looked startled. She said, "Don't be embarrassed. I saw he picked you up. Later, I heard voices in your bedroom." I sometimes heard noises in her bedroom, but turned up music to drown them out. She said, "God doesn't want us to go through our lives alone, no matter how hard it is to be with someone." I wondered how this fit theologically. I was not converted, damned, but with a boyfriend, I'd be less damned. That weekend, the phone rang, a call from a party a few blocks away. A classmate told the revelers she was sure I owned a blender. I heard laughing and shouting. Then a guy got on the phone and asked me to bring over my blender because he was making margaritas. I should have stayed home and worked on a paper, but I'd been worrying. Men and women had paired off since the beginning of time. Why was it hard now? I had only an inkling that the trouble with love wasn't just my confusion, though it was in part, but also the era's, a slow shift in understanding what wooing and mating would be during a large-scale movement of women into new professions, large-scale movement, period, mobility, not just upward, but away from familiar communities where you date your neighbor's cousin or someone you met at your sister's wedding, friends serving as dating letters of reference. No wonder arranged marriages persist, I thought. But every time I wondered if my choices had been affected by factors beyond my control, I resisted. What did I have if not control? Just second-hand furniture, an old car, and a blender. I put the blender in a huge purse and went to the party and met my second husband. I did this to distract myself, or to keep options open, avenues to the future. I didn't marry him that night, but I drank too much and brought him home.
I'm so glad you read that section. I really love that section.
I probably wouldn't have married him, but, you know, he was from Texas.
Yeah.
And he liked tequila and good music. And in academia, or when my choices were guys I met in grad school or guys who were Mormon, mm-hmm. I thought he was the one.
Right.
Tire les ficelles, tire les ficelles, ton polichinelle te tendra les bras.
You've been listening to KUT. This is the Write-Up with Owen Edgerton, a KUT-produced program that talks to writers about their lives and the stories behind stories. Deborah, let me ask you one last question. I wanted to ask, there's so many Deborahs in this book. There's child Deborah all the way through adult Deborah. There's mother Deborah. There's married Deborah. There's unmarried Deborah. If you could go back, this is a bit of a silly question in some ways, but if you could go back in time and talk to this younger self, before she is an award-winning writer and before she is a working professor, what advice would you give her?
I'd tell her not to worry so much about the mistakes, because if you're paying attention, it'll all turn out well. But she wouldn't have believed me. And so it would have been useless advice. We're hardwired not to believe what our elders tell us.
That, I suppose so. And if she had believed you, it might not have been as interesting a memoir. This has been The Write-Up with Owen Edgerton, a KUT-produced program. And we've been talking to Deborah Monroe about her latest memoir, My Unsentimental Education. She'll be reading from her book and signing it at Book People here in downtown Austin on October 24th at 4 p.m. Deborah, thank you so much for being here and sharing with us from your life and your craft and from your book.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
The Write-Up is produced by Rebecca McEnroy. Today was engineered by Jake Perlman. It is a KUT production. I'm Owen Edgerton. Thank you so much for listening.